My name is Maggie Ferris, and this is the second part of a two-part series on Christian deterrence to personal assault. I think most of you were here last night. Let's begin where we always should begin, with the Word of God. I'm going to read from 2 Corinthians 5:19 to 6:10. I mean that God in Christ was reconciling the world to himself, not counting humanity's transgressions against them, and that God has entrusted the message of reconciliation to us. This makes us ambassadors for Christ, God, as it were, appealing through us. We implore you in Christ's name, be reconciled to God. For our sakes, God made the one who did not know sin to be sin, so that in him we might become the very holiness of God. As your fellow workers, we beg you not to receive the grace of God in vain. For God says, in an acceptable time I have heard you, on a day of salvation I have helped you. Now is the acceptable time. Now is the day of salvation. We avoid giving anyone offense so that our ministry may not be blamed. On the contrary, in all that we do, we must strive to present ourselves as ministers of God, acting with patient endurance amid trials, difficulties, distresses, beatings, imprisonments, and riots, as people familiar with hard work, sleepless nights, and fastings, conducting ourselves with innocence, knowledge, and patience in the Holy Spirit, in sincere love, as people with the message of truth and the power of God, wielding the weapons of righteousness with right hand and left, whether honored or dishonored, spoken well of or ill of. We are called impostors, yet we are truthful. Nobodies who in fact are well known, dead, yet here we are, alive. Punished but not put to death, sorrowful, though we are always rejoicing, poor, yet we enrich many. We seem to have nothing, yet everything is ours.
Would you repeat which one?
This is 2 Corinthians 5:19, 6:10. Can everybody hear me? Mm-hmm. Okay. Go like this if you can't. So as Christians, we're called to be reconcilers, just as Christ reconciled us to God, so we are to act as reconciling agents for conversion to all we meet in every situation. Last night we asked the question, as Christians, are we called to love our enemies even in an assault situation? And I proposed, yes, that we are. Today I hope to help you envision what that looks like in an assault situation. Last night I talked about nonviolence and deterrence. Nonviolence, I said, is active. It's not non-defense. It is a method of defense, but beyond that, it's a method of reconciliation and conversion, disarming ourselves and hence the other person. Nonviolence is not a set of techniques, but an inner attitude out of which our disarming actions flow. I define the power of nonviolence as the power to face someone who confronts us as enemy and to still allow love and grace to so permeate the meeting that violence becomes a hindrance and conversion becomes a possibility. I define Christian deterrence as the moment of participation in the redemptive love of Christ, supporting a person in his or her movement away from destruction. I stated that in order to be about building the kingdom of God, we must be willing to use kingdom methods. Nowhere in the Christian scriptures is there a mandate to destroy that which is evil. Rather, Christ calls us to create a context for conversion. Christ places himself in situations where there's a chance for interaction with the enemy and consequently engages in forgiveness, reconciliation, and conversion. And again, in an assault situation, we have to ask ourselves, what do we desire? Do we desire to win over the other, to teach them a lesson, to annihilate them, or do we desire their safety and well-being? The gospel calls us to desire wholeness for our enemies. In Matthew 5, we're told that the love of God reigns on the just and the unjust alike, that the assailant's life is just as valued as our own. And I believe that with the inbreaking of the kingdom of God, the whole notion of the favored nation status ended, that God loves all equally, hence we are called to love the other as ourselves, which sounds crazy. Somebody's going to rape me, and I'm going to love them. But I think we're called by the gospel. If we can't get into loving that person, at least we can free up within ourselves a respect for the fact that that is a loved person, loved by the God that loves me. But we're all called with the same love, originating with the parent God. And because of that love, that non-discriminating love, the assailant's safety is as important as my safety. And if we're not going to make it through the encounter together safely, neither one of us will make it through. Nonviolence means that I effectively realize that this is a loved person, so I act out of my concern for our mutual safety. My action is a lived choice that as God's love is for me, so it is for the other. And nonviolence is simply the manifestation of my commitment and participation in that love. Assault situations are crisis situations of potential redemption, and it is a ministry of reconciliation that we're involved in. We have to become reconciling in this present assault situation. We have to allow ourselves to be liberating agents for somebody else. And we as victim can either facilitate the assailant's ability to change his or her mind and not to strike out at us, or by our own actions we can force them to choose to hurt us. Again, it's that whole concept of creating a context for conversion. Not to deny the risk. The risk is certainly there, but there's also the call, the truth, the power of Christ, and the grace of God. I'm just going to go over real quickly. Yesterday I reviewed the theories of aggression and stated that I define violence or aggression as a manifestation of human brokenness, and then went through the five levels of personal power. The first being the power to be, which is manifest from infancy, satisfied with responsive parenting. If that's not satisfied, then we affirm it and we go after self-affirmation, where the need to be significant or self-esteem emerge. If that's not satisfied, we assert ourselves, say, here I am. If that isn't satisfied, we become aggressive. Here I am, I demand that you notice me. And then we move into violence, where there's a breakdown of the object relationship, and it's a physiological event occurring in a psychological context. So that was yesterday, in a nutshell, for those of you who weren't here. Given the fact that the assailant presents themselves as a broken person, we have the choice. Do we want to illuminate their brokenness, or are we going to illuminate or reach for that of God in them? If one person attacks us with physical violence and the victim hits back, the violent response gives the attacker a certain sense of reassurance and moral support. This is some research that came out of Richard Gregg's work. It shows that the position of violence on the victim's scale of moral values is the same as that of the attacker. If two people are fighting, it looks like they're in discord, but in effect, they're both in agreement on one thing, that violence is an okay method, that it's okay to fight, and therefore they're both united in that very principle. A mere display of either fear or anger on a victim's part will reinforce the fact that violence is okay and will have the same effect. Not to say that fear or anger aren't going to be there, because you're going to be very fearful and very angry, but the trick is just not to act out of them. And again, that takes a lot of prayer and thought beforehand. It's not going to come naturally. A violent or angry or a fearful response will make the attacker sure of his or her choice of methods, of his or her knowledge of human nature, and hence his or her knowledge of the victim. The assailant comes into a situation expecting a definite scenario. They know exactly what's going to happen. They're going to lash out, and you or the victim is going to scream, is going to become fearful. That's what they expect. And hence their morale is sustained and their sense of values is vindicated. If the assailant encounters a person who acts fearless or is calm and steady and who has a different belief, training, or experience, and therefore acts with much more self-control, who offers resistance only in moral terms, then the assailant undergoes a loss of inner assurance. The assailant will be increasingly aware that the victim's scale of values is different from their own. And a continuing cause of relative weakness in the attacker is that they are in a suggestible and very receptive state of mind and emotion because of that. As soon as the encounter doesn't go as they expected, they become very receptive and suggestible. And the surprising conduct of the victim and the attitude of the victim suddenly presents a new idea to the attacker, and the effect of this surprise is to make us attend to the event that surprises us. There's some very good research done on theories of aggression and on the control and prevention of aggression done by Goldstein et al. From the Center for Research on Aggression out of Syracuse University. They've done, I think, some of the finest work on aggression. Their findings were published in a book in 1983 called The Prevention and Control of Aggression. And basically, they conclude that you cannot be in a state of mild humor or of wonder or of surprise and in a state of aggression and violence at the same time. It's physiologically incompatible, that you cannot be surprised and yet lash out at the same time, which is I think, one of the main, and I'll go through some stories, techniques that helps to keep us safe in an assault-type situation. Richard Gregg wrote a book, The Power of Nonviolence, and he describes this whole principle as moral jujitsu, that just as in physical jujitsu, there's an exchange, and the person who's skilled in jujitsu will kind of physically pull back and get the other person off of their center. So also in moral jujitsu, you want to create an environment where you can kind of pull the person morally off center and bring them to a higher level of relating. Violence is an attempt to stop the conflict at the level of conflict, whereas nonviolence will try to bring it up to a higher moral plane. Richard Gregg states, the nonviolent resistor seeks to help the violent attacker to reestablish his moral balance on a higher level and more secure than that from which he first launched his violent attack. The function of the nonviolent type of resistance is not to harm the opponent nor impose a solution against his will, but to help both parties into a more secure, creative, happy, and truthful relationship. Let's look at some other principles of nonviolence. Generally speaking, violence arms and nonviolence disarms. I don't think you can see this, but I'll basically give you what it says. The first principle is that hostility breeds greater hostility. I talked about that yesterday. That's how we got from the crossbow to the MX missile, that it just is a spiral that kind of goes downward, and you want to interject. You want to interject an open response to stop that spiral from going into a more and more violent direction. The assailant operates from a definite set of scenario or set of expectations and needs the victim to act as a victim in order to feed the interplay, and just to feed the hostile action and then the reaction. The study that Goldstein et al. Did shows that panic breeds increased cruelty. If you react with panic, it's going to make an assailant become more cruel. Helplessness will only breed greater rage, which people don't often realize. A violent or a hostile or a panic or a helpless response reinforces the assailant's expectations, self-confidence, and sense of self-control, the sense of control of the situation. The little bear there, just as that's an aside, these kind of techniques sort of work on bears too. If you are carrying yourself, you know, in a really fearful posture and you see a bear and you start to run, the bear is going to run after you. Whereas if you can just talk to a bear kind of calmly and just walk backwards, it works on bears too. A lot of deterrence has to do with how are you carrying yourself. Just like that study I talked about last night, how sure are you when you're walking down the street? I took one of Angie's courses on Christian transpersonal assault quite a few years ago and realized how important body language was and how important it was that I, you know, started interaction with people. And I found myself walking down the street, and every time I'd see somebody who was kind of scary, would look like somebody who might assault me, I'd always say something like, "Hi, how you doing?" Or I'd create some kind of an interaction. And then I found myself going down the streets just talking to scary looking people. There's something wrong with this. That, you know, it was kind of sexist and ageist, and So it really made me aware of how I was acting on the streets and who I was talking to, and I think made a friendlier person out of me and made me much more comfortable on the streets. And since then, I've gotten into some really interesting interactions. One of them, I was walking to work to the hospital early one morning. It was like 5:30, it was still dark. And I always walk on the side of the street that the buses come, so I always had the excuse of turning around and looking for a bus, although I never am looking for the bus. And suddenly this man came up behind me, and he was obviously very, very large because his shadow just way outstretched mine. And I became a little bit scared. And it was just before I was doing one of these workshops, and I thought, how ironic that I'm going to get beaten up just before I do one of these workshops. But so there I was walking, and this big shadow and engulfed mine, and I quick turned around and I said, "Good morning, do you know, is there a bus coming?" And this guy just jumped, and here, the streetlight must have been way behind him because he was the tiniest man I ever saw in my whole life, and his shadow was just big because the light was so low. And so he kind of jumped into the curb, and he was kind of scared of me, I think, and he just said, no, I don't. He said, "Here, you have my paper, do you want my paper?" And so we started talking, and we had this little interchange. And he walked on the curb almost the whole way for about a mile. We walked together with him kind of on the street, keeping his distance from me. And at the end, as it turns out, he just got a job as a cab driver, had been through chemical dependency treatment, just a lot of hard times. And he was just really open. He asked me to light a candle for him. And that's a Catholic practice, lighting candles. And which I had never gotten into, but I did. And he then, at the end, gave me his paper. He said, "Well, why don't you take my paper anyway?" And he put his phone number on it at the cab place, and he said, "If ever you need a ride, and a cab ride, just call me." So anyway, it's gotten me into a lot of interesting situations, and I've got free cab rides and things. Where were we? Okay.
Maggie, do you think that he was going to assault you?
No, probably not, but all the same, I think just to initiate an interaction is a real wise thing, to become a person to that person, and to take it into your own hands. If you can, it says, I'm a person who has control of myself, and I'm going to take initiative.
Mm-hmm.
And so that is just a wise way of being on the streets, to make eye contact, to maintain your own sense of personal space. One of the first things that people oftentimes will do is to try to ask you a question before they decide whether or not they're going to take your purse or they're going to try to hold you up. And they'll come close enough and ask direction-type questions. And if you're very much in control and maintain your own personal space, usually they'll see you not as a good victim. So the way you carry yourself, I think, is immensely important. The unexpected non-hostile response can have a highly disarming effect on an assailant. Again, there's that whole sense of surprise and wonder. A good story to illustrate this is my friend Angie Gorman, who I do this workshop with. One of her assault situations occurred in St. Louis a number of years ago. She was working in a Catholic worker house, which at the time was closed down for repairs. And anybody who's familiar with the Catholic worker movement knows that when a Catholic worker house is closed down, it just means all the staff needs a rest. But she was the only one in the house. There were boarded up buildings on either side and empty lots. And she was asleep. It was about 2:30 in the morning. And suddenly she woke up with her door being knocked in and a man standing over her, a very large man. And she, again, never would have thought of doing this. It just kind of came to her. She looked up at him and she said, "Say, do you know what time it is?" And crazy response. I mean, and he kind of, you know, moved his watch that he could see it through the street light coming in, and he said, "Well, it's about 2:15. And she said, "You know, that's strange because my watch here says, my clock says 2:30, and I just said it before I went to bed by the radio, and you know, maybe your watch is wrong. Have you checked it lately?" And they got into this absurd conversation about the time. Here's this man standing over a man. And it was enough to just change. It gave her at least an indication that she could engage him and get him off whatever he was planning on doing. And she said, "Say, how did you get in here anyway?" And he said, well, I broke the front window. And she said, well, that really makes me angry because it's a Catholic worker house and we don't have that much money to replace the window. And he said, well, what's a Catholic worker house? And she said, well, it's a place that provides housing for people who have nowhere to go. And he said, oh, good, because I need a place to stay tonight. So she said, well, downstairs, there are bedrooms downstairs, but there are no sheets on the bed. You'd have to make your own bed, but I can show you where the sheets are, and you can stay there. Which, of course, she didn't sleep all night. But in the morning, they had breakfast, and they talked about how he was going to pay for the window. And you know, tried to work some of that out. So it was, again, that sense of, it completely knocked him off guard. He came in, standing over her bedroom. Of course she was going to scream in his mind, and she was going to start to fight and struggle. But instead she asked him, what time is it? Crazy thing. Something you would never think about, but again, she was confident enough to just come up with that. So wonder diffuses cruelty, and attracts attention to the thing which caused the wonder. It distracts from anger and the cruelty. I've got that little picture of the book, Sisterhood is Powerful. There's a woman who was in one of the workshops who was a physical education teacher, and she was trained in all of these techniques of self-defense, you know, how to push somebody's eyes out with your thumbs and the Chrysler key trick and all of that. And she found herself in her own home, and someone had broken into her house and was trying to rape her. And in the process, she realized that she could no more push her thumbs through his eyes than she could do anything. It was just something she could not do. And so she, as he was trying to assault her, she just looked at him and she said, I wonder how you would feel if somebody were doing this to your sister. And that was just enough for him to not be able to complete the act. Probably the guy had a sister, hopefully. that was, you know, enough for her just asking how would you feel. So again, wonder tends to leave a person in a heightened state of suggestibility and allows the victim to redirect the encounter. Got that little $5 bill there. I'm going to read a story out of Dorothy Samuel's book, Safe Passage on City Streets. It's a book that's out of print, but was printed by the Quakers, and is a real excellent resource on stories of people who have been in an assault-type situation and were able to disarm the other so that neither got hurt. It reads, in 1972, two quite ordinary young women in Philadelphia walked out one night to pay their rent. They carried neither bag nor purse. Having paid the rent, they drifted home penniless, rather obviously penniless. Yet on the dark, empty city street, they were suddenly confronted by a tall youth who held a knife to the throat of the one nearest him. I want money. I have to have money. Were either to flee, they recognized at once the other would fall to the knife. This very normal love determined their first choice. I will not sacrifice my friend for myself. Love is a self-feeding explosion, just as fear is. Perhaps this first almost instinctual release of love set the course for their whole response pattern, even to the junkie threatening them. I don't want to do this, he began protesting. I don't like to hurt people, but sometimes I have to. The knife moved closer. And if I have to, I will now. If I don't get money, someone is going to get hurt. But we don't have any money. I have to have money. They began thinking of alternatives for him. None of them would do. If I don't get this money, you'll get hurt. Look, said the smaller one, chin firm over the knife. I'll stay here with you. Let Mary go back to my apartment and get you the money. No way, she'll call the cops. No, she won't. Really, she won't. And I'll be here. She won't call the cops while I'm still here. Still no one on the street. The three stood in an intimate little drama, knife blackened to avoid the light. A strange understanding began to grow in the young woman. He really didn't like to do this. He really was miserable. He was also irrational and more frightened, really, than they. Look, you come back with us. I have some money in my apartment. You come with us. No, your husband will be there. Some man will be there. The jerky threat of the knife again. There's no one there, honestly. The apartment is empty. Look, trust us. We'll get the money. You'll call the fuzz. Trust us. Come on, we'll all go. Slowly, knife at the ready, he he began to move along the dark street with them. The young women kept talking quietly and normally. At the outer door, he held back again, pulled her nearer to the knife. Just upstairs, there's no one there. Just trust us. Inside the foyer, up the stairs, key in the lock, and the other young woman took over the position under the knife while the smaller one went into her apartment and rummaged for her purse. $10. A $10 bill was the only money she had. She ran back to the door and thrust it at him. Is that all you have? A sudden sinking feeling. After all this, after the appearance of trust, the seeming solution of their predicament, was he going to demand more? She had no more. And her apartment door stood open behind her. That's all. That's all, really. But I only need $5. I don't have change. From threat to apology, the role of crook has been lost when the young women refuse the role of terrified victim. Take it, take it. That's all right. But I only need $5. His hands were shaking, his voice trembling. He looked down at the bill, back into the young woman's eyes. Bye, she said. Bye now. And he slithered down the steps and out into the night. These women were able to support him and to try to tell him over and over and over again, trust us, look, trust us. And you know, he needed $5 and he tried to give them change. So the assault situation is a very delicate moment and requires intense sensitivity and training. The person that confronts you has all the fear, if not more fear than you have yourself. I'm gonna just go through some nonviolent principles, and again, the principles are not as important as the inner attitude. If you are using all of these principles and yet secretly underneath wish to annihilate the person, that's going to come through. That would be your desire will be apparent to the assailant, and hence you would not be safe, nor would they. The first principle is to become a person to the assailant. That's number one. Anything you can do to establish who you are, that you're not just an object. And again, that whole dynamic is at play where somebody who's violently lashing out is just sees you as an object, you're not a person. So if you can talk about your family, if you can talk about just anything, where you're going, what you were doing, it's going to tend to make you be safer in that situation. And it will allow that person to kind of break that violent the outrage that is coming at you. It will help them to just slow down. Anger is a real hard thing to sustain. To be angry for a real long time takes up a whole lot of energy. And anything you can do to break that will help the person regain their sense of self and control.
Does it help to say, gosh, you seem so angry?
I would use your instincts in the given situation. It may or may not. But just to show, I mean, in saying that, you would be saying to the person that you're concerned about them and whatever is causing that. So it may work, or it may just help them get more in touch with the fact that, yes, I'm really angry. But I think generally it would be probably disarming kind of a technique. The other thing you want to do is be very clear about your objectives. Just think beforehand, again, what do you desire? Do you desire the safety of all, the wholeness of that person? And you have the goal of breaking the cycle of violence that you're not out to win. It is very helpful to think about that whenever you enter any conflict situation. The other thing is not to act frightened and to maintain eye contact. Not to say that you won't be frightened, but just don't act frightened. Again, that sense of helplessness will only increase their sense of rage. You want to keep talking and to encourage the other person to talk, to continue a dialogue. You want to, in order to do that, what's helpful is not to ask yes-no questions, but open-ended questions, which will enable them to give you more of a response. You don't want to be frightening. That sounds kind of crazy, that you might frighten them, but again, they've got all the fear that you have. and make sure that your defense doesn't appear as an offense. Like when I turned around to the cab driver, I'm sure it completely scared him. And to remember that a person doing an aggressive act probably has all the fear you have. We've said that a few times. You want to state the obvious. So many times somebody is involved in a violent action, and just to state the obvious, you might hurt them. We'll just stop them in their tracks. That happened to me once when I was, this was maybe about a year and a half ago, I was driving down the street, 7th Avenue in Minneapolis, and there were two bikes in the street. So I just stopped my car, and they were going to get run over. It's a pretty busy street. And I picked up the bikes to put them on the sidewalk when all of a sudden these two kids came running, huge, maybe teenage black kids, 17, 18 years old, big guys. And one had a U-lock and was going to hit the other one. Ironically, the one that was going to hit the other one was the one that hit, he's the one who hit the other one with his bike. He was the one who did the wrongdoing, but he was afraid that his bike had gotten hurt, and he was upset with the other one just for being in his way, I guess. He was really, and he was going to just beat this kid with this huge bike lock. And so I just walked up to them and kind of put one hand on either shoulder of the two of them and looked at the one with the U-lock, and I said, "You might hurt him." And he just put his arm down right away. Well, of course he wanted to hurt him, but it was enough to just, you know, that I was intervening at all, I think, caught him off guard. And so I looked at the one who who didn't have the U-lock, and I said, "Get your bike and put it in the trunk." I handed the trunk key to my car. And so he just dutifully just got his bike, he put it in the trunk, and I said, "Now get into the car." And he got into the car. I talked a little bit with the one with the U-lock, how inappropriate that was, and that he needed to control his anger more. And then I got into the car with the other young man. Just as I was getting in, the kid with the U-lock said, "Hey, is that your son?" <That's> so obvious. For the listening audience, I'm white. That he was obviously not my son. And so it was just kind of funny. So we got into the car, and I had at that time John Piper's doctoral dissertation, Love Your Enemies, and it was there right in between the two seats, and he looked at it, and he, as it turns out, was in school at St. Thomas Military Academy, which is run by the Christian Brothers, and he told me that we're just kind of chit-chatting, where do you go to school kind of conversation. And I thought, how ironic that the Christian Brothers have this military academy, and I pointed that out to him, and he just said, "Well, we've got to protect ourselves. That's all that works, is we've got to be able to protect ourselves." And I said, "Well, wait a second. What just happened between you and this friend, and how did I break it up? Did I hold him? Did I punch him?" And then he just kind of smiled, and he said, "No, we had this great talk about nonviolent techniques and how maybe there is another way." It was real fun to be able to talk about that, having just demonstrated it for him.
Maybe that touch on the shoulder, too, is very common.
Yeah, a lot of times with your body, you can use certain techniques just to, like I was creating a bridge between them by touching both of their shoulders. So there are a lot of ways, you know, if you're standing like this with somebody with your arms crossed across your chest versus a more open posture where your arms are with your hands open at your side and you're looking straight at the person, you're giving them a lot of different messages. Usually what you say is just about 7% of what's being communicated. Body language is at least 55%. So the other thing that you want to do is not to behave like a victim. Again, that helplessness, the panic, will just increase their cruelty and their rage. You want to, it's almost like a dance in some ways. When you're in that kind of a situation, just as when you're dancing, you want to kind of gently get your partner where you want to go without them really knowing it. It's kind of a give and a take, and you both have to be in sync. So in an assault situation, you want to just gently support them and take the upper ground. You as victim morally have an upper ground, and you have much more wholeness about you. Take it. Don't behave like a victim. And the other real important thing, again, is to use the element of surprise, mild humor, or wonder. They work very well. It'll break that cycle of aggression. You want to seek to befriend your opponent's better nature. to go after that of God in them. Just as yesterday in the situation I told you about, when I explained to the assailant that I had all these things I had to do, he responded in a good and right manner. You want to be firm yet gentle with your eye contact, with your voice, your choice of actions, your body posture. You want to talk a lot, but more importantly, you want to listen a lot. You want to create an environment where you can allow that person to express themselves. And you have to remember to act out of your common humanity, that this is a person loved by God. I'm going to tell a story of my most recent assault situation, because I made some mistakes and did some things that were effective. And then hopefully we can do a little exercise on him. 2 Octobers ago. It was last October. I was running in Theodore Worth Parkway on the near north side of Minneapolis. And my family was out of town, so I was home alone for the weekend. And as I was running, I anticipated getting home just before dark. But I was running slower than I had anticipated I would run, and it was dark before I got there. And as I was making a curve, just almost home, just under the Plymouth Avenue Bridge, for those of you who are familiar with Minneapolis, a man came out from behind the bushes, and he stopped and asked me, "Where's Plymouth Avenue?" And I stopped to tell him. And I was, you know, pointing up to the bridge. I was kind of out of breath and not real aware of what was going on. And then he just kind of grabbed my arm and he said, "Come on, we're going this way," and started pulling me into the bushes. Well, I had been doing these workshops for quite a few years, so I, of course, was the expert and knew what I was doing. I was absolutely panicked. I was so scared that there was no way I could be free of any kind of concern for this guy. He had just wild eyes. He looked like he was a drug addict and that he was completely irrational. I was just absolutely petrified. And he had me, by this time we're struggling and he pinned up against a tree. And I kept thinking, you know, what should I be doing? And I was thinking of techniques. I was just sure that this man was going to kill me. Nobody would know about it because nobody was home until Sunday night. Nobody would even miss me or look for me. And this is kind of a secluded area. And suddenly there was, on the path came this man who was the second smallest man I've ever seen in my whole life with a dog. And I was going to scream, of course, just so he would help me, when I realized this guy was so little that he couldn't do any more than I could do, and we're all going to get into this big fiasco. I didn't know if there was a weapon involved or anything. And so I think because I was able to free up some concern for the little guy, the puny guy, that I also realized that some concern for the assailant. It wasn't until that point when I realized that we're all going to get hurt. And so I took the assailant by the arm and used his, he by then was starting to get really scared and nervous, and you could just see he was kind of trembling and was really unsure of what to do, if he should run or what, and he had let up on my shoulders, and I was no longer impaled against the tree. And so I took his arm and I said, "Come on, we're going this way." He used his exact same line and started walking him down the path, and there was a kind of a footing underneath the bridge, and I just kind of sat him down. I knew I wanted to become a person to him, and so I just said, "Look, I've got to get home to my family," which is kind of a lie, but I wanted to at least establish the fact that I was a mother and I had a family that I needed to get back to. And I said, "What about you? Do you have any family?" Just to get him talking. And he explained that he was from Alabama, but, you know, and that he had, you know, 5, 6 brothers and sisters, but that now he lived here. And he said, what are you doing?" He was really surprised, just the look of, "Why are you doing this?" he said. And I said, "Well, if we had done whatever you had thought about doing, chances are real good I would have been hurt and you would have also been hurt, maybe ended up in prison." And I said, "I think it would be much better if you and I just talked, that we'd get much more out of both of us." And so we talked for quite a while. I kept asking him questions. As it turns out, he was a junkie. And he was the person who, in Vietnam, he was the executioner. He was a Marine. Went right into the Marines I don't think he graduated from high school, but went right into the Marines as soon as he could. And when they went into Vietnam, during the Vietnam era, and captured little cities, he was the one who, when they lined up all the women and children and old men and old women and babies, he was the one that gunned them down. That was his whole experience. And then he was in a prisoner of war camp for 19 months. Just an immense amount, was sexually abused as a kid, just an immense amount of brokenness. And we talked for about an hour and a half, and by that time I was really, really cold. It was October. And I didn't know if this was still an assault situation or if I was free to leave. And so I asked him to walk me home, which probably was not the soundest thing because I've got three Vietnamese foster kids, and if one of them had come out at the time, it would have been not the best scene. But he did walk me home, and on the way home he asked me what kind of flowers I liked. What was my favorite flowers? And I told him daisies. That was one of the things that, you know, we had talked about, just kind of chit-chatted on the way home. He left. I went into the house. And again, I'm not sure how smart that was to ask him to walk me home. But I did. It was just my way of getting out of there because I was just really cold. And the next morning when I got up and went out of the house, I found between the doors a little bunch of daisies with a little note that said, "Thanks for being my friend." I had, after that, maybe about 3 or 4 months, I toyed with, should I call the police in that whole question. And I ran into him about 3 months later. I was in the YMCA in the Near North Side of Minneapolis. I was in my swimsuit in the sauna, and he walked in. And I was just felt that whole sense of vulnerability and anger, and I couldn't say anything to him. I couldn't be reconciling or healing or how are you doing. I just couldn't. I just left the sauna and went and got dressed and was really shook just by that sense of being a victim. And then when I got out into the lobby, he had already gotten dressed and he was there, and he just kind of came up to me and he said, "Maggie, I just want you to know that spiritually I'm in a much better spot now." So that was real hopeful to me that maybe that interaction had some effect on him or some, you know, aided him in some sense of healing. Since then, I've kind of kept track of him through other people on the street, and he's doing quite well. The problem for me is always, and one of the questions I always get in these workshops is, what do you do afterwards with police? How do you follow up, and what role does the police and the whole judicial system have to play in the assault situation if you're able to deter it? And my sense is you have to go situation by situation and trust your instinct, but that the judicial system right now is one of retribution, and we need to be looking at models of restoration. There's some really good work being done by the Lombardi Institute, the Mennonites are doing outside of Chicago, where they have developed a program that uses a restorative model of reconciliation between victims and offenders. And some of that research has been printed up, and they've got a book on that whole process, which I have here. But it basically brings together the victim and the offender. And their statistics are that 75% of the people who go through their program do not repeat within 5 years. They're not repeat offenders. Whereas in the judicial system, 75% do repeat within 5 years. So that's a real exciting concept for me, and I think it bears a lot of time and attention on our part, looking at models of reconciliation once a crime has occurred.
Maggie, have you ever done any programs for the police?
I've had some police people come to some of the workshops, and that's been really interesting to have that kind of exchange, because there are, and when we did our videotape, I had one of the police officers that does some training for my home police department review the video. So that's been an interesting exchange. And they basically do use a lot of the same techniques of trying to be calm and talk somebody down, not pulling out the revolver, that sort of a thing. Most police are pretty skilled in the technique, because they know it's going to keep them safer. Most of these techniques are just proven to keep you safer. Again, that's not the focus of what I want to do. I want to look at the inner attitude. How do we love our enemies? Because I think that's where the conversion of ourselves takes place. And the whole concept of trusting God in any situation, that's the real challenge in this whole, all this material.
I'm just remembering in Golden Valley, which is a suburb of Minneapolis, and when the police were kind of beating up on black people, and they would go through Golden Valley a number of years ago, and they really were, they would arrest any black person who walked through Golden Valley. And a lot of workshops were established to change the attitude of the policeman. So, and now Golden Valley is one of the better places to live. And they have a lot of black people living there. And so an attitudinal change is what I'm driving at.
Yeah, that's good work, well worth it, because there's a lot of discrimination, within that system. I've lived in predominantly black neighborhoods for most of the past 10 years, 15 years, and it's just been amazing to me the frame-ups. I had a friend come and visit me. He's a corporate executive to one of the major companies, and he was picked up for supposedly raping somebody across town. And what got him off was just the fact that she talked about the click of his heels behind her, and he was wearing tennis shoes at the time. But it's just amazing the incidents of especially black men who get picked up for crimes they did not do. And I've served on jury, did jury duty, and it was just amazing to me the description and then the pictures and how people mistake people who don't look anything like the other person. There's a lot of injustice there. And also looking in the prison system when you go in, the people who end up in prison, it's upsetting, a lack of justice. Mm-hmm. Do you want to have some time for questions, answers? And then if we have time, we'll do a little bit of a...
You indicated that I may have missed it, the question, why do rapists rape, why do muggers mug?
Uh-huh.
And so forth. Are you going to get into that?
Okay. Were you here yesterday?
Yes.
Oh, but yeah, I think that basically people who get involved in violent crimes, people who are rapists, are acting out of their own brokenness, and the answer is that they're acting out of their own human brokenness for whatever reason. Muggers, lack of money, usually financial resources. Rapists, it's a lot more in depth. And it has to do with their own, usually childhood experiences.
It can be an anger abuse. Against the system that they themselves.
It can be an anger against the system. It can be an anger against the type of category, women, mother type anger, brokenness, in terms of rape. But usually, it's a lack of power, a lack of personal power, and so they're going to take that power over somebody else. It's much more of a power or an anger dynamic. It's not at all sexual. Many rapists have a lot of sexual difficulties. It's not a sexual motivation at all.
Right. What about people who are organic dysfunctional brain problems, personality problems, that you can't talk down? I don't know what the ratio would be of meeting those kind of people to people that have some... It sounds like the people that you have been involved with were extremely angry, upset, hurting people, but somewhere in their brain they had a sense of right and wrong, or a sense of...
Well, they're pretty dysfunctional people, most of them, but you're talking about people who are losing touch with reality, that sort of thing. I
guess that's what scares me the most.
Yeah. I've taken part in some workshops with nurses who work on psychiatric wards and mental health wards, and a lot of the dynamics that are involved there are basically that you still want to create that environment of calm, and you don't want to, when somebody's really losing touch with reality, a lot of the same principles. Maybe they will not be as effective, but you want to remain calm, you want to keep them talking, you want to use a very calming voice and maintain eye contact and express concern for them. Yeah. And at some points you have to, in a mental health setting, they teach you to restrain the person.
Yeah.
And again, that, different people see that as being violent or not.
When you're out on the street running, though, you don't have the guys on the war that you can signal to come and do a rap on.
You can. Yeah, and I think, again, that's a pretty small statistic in terms of people who are doing personal harm when they get to that state of being so out of touch. But again, there are those, you know, we read about them in the paper now and then, those really scary people who are shooting strangers and have a gun. And I'm not sure that, again, that that's a situation that violence will work in either. This isn't 100% foolproof. I'm not sure that in those situations, even if you had a gun, that you could deter, that you could, you know, shoot the person. And again, that's usually in most, where there's no chance for any kind of an interaction, no matter what you do, violence or non-violence, you're going to get hurt anyway. You know, these dynamics will only work when there's a chance for some kind of interaction in the response.
What about carrying mace?
Pardon?
What about carrying mace?
Well, again, that's a...
just makes them mad.
Well, yeah, that's just gonna increase. You're saying, I don't care about you, I want to hurt you. Mm-hmm. And the question is that what we as Christians mm-hmm. are all about? So, I want to do just a little exercise. We'll read a couple of stories of interactions, and we as a group can kind of decide whether they're good, bad, violent, or nonviolent. Just to kind of stress the dynamics involved. And as I read the story, we can kind of talk about where to put it on this whole range, whether it's neither good nor bad, but it is nonviolent, whether it's kind of violent and bad way down here, we can kind of decide where to put it. Does that make sense? Okay, story number A. This is a true story about a woman who lives on the near south side of Minneapolis. One evening, she was walking alone down Franklin Avenue when a man approached her from behind and began talking with her. They exchanged several brief comments about the weather and where they were going when he suddenly held a knife at her back and said, "You're coming with me." The woman turned around and quickly took a firm stance and shouted in a very demeaning tone, "You should be ashamed of yourself. How dare you hold a knife to a woman? What kind of awful person are you? Didn't your mother teach you any better? Shame on you." The whole time, she shook her finger at the young man and the assailant's hand with a knife, and it dropped to his side, and he turned and ran away. Where does that fit? Is it?
Good.
It was good. She kept herself and he safe. Now the question is, was it violent or nonviolent?
No.
She was kind of...
I would say it was violent. Because
she, depending on his mood, would could have turned it off.
Yeah. You're saying because she said, "Shame on you," what kind of personality?
No, because you're shaking your finger. That's like a challenge.
Yeah. So, do the rest of you agree that that was maybe a little violent?
Mm-hmm.
So you put it what?
So it was good, but a little violent. What do you say?
A little longer. Mm-hmm.
Okay. Let's go on to B. These are all true stories, by the way. Tom Witt and I kind of developed this little exercise. He's the National Director of the Lutheran Peace Fellowship. One evening, a few years back, a very tired waitress, alone, just before closing a small cafe, was suddenly confronted by an armed intruder. He ordered her to give the money from the register, but she just sat on where she was, resting her feet. "I'm sick," she complained. "I couldn't move if I had to." There was nothing to prevent the gunman from opening the register himself. She was no threat. She wasn't even interested. But he left. What's that? Is that good? Bad?
Good.
Good. Is it violent? Nonviolent?
Nonviolent.
Up here? How do you say?
Go for it, Maggie.
Okay, C. This is one of my favorite ones. Several years ago, Mike Hovey, who's the director of the Pax Christi Center on Conscience and War in Boston, was walking down the streets of Boston at night when three large men came up from behind him. One man tightly grasped Mike's neck from behind with his arm and said in a hurried, harsh voice, kind of like this, "This is a holdup." Mike stood still. He did not struggle and calmly stated in a matter-of-fact voice, "No, you're wrong. This is not a holdup." The man said, "What?" Mike repeated, "This is not a holdup, because in order for this to be a holdup, I'd have to have money, and I don't, so this is not a holdup." And he kind of laughed. "Actually, I think I have 50 cents in my pocket, which hardly constitutes a holdup, but I gladly give it to you." He smiled. The man loosened his grip and said in a somewhat understanding and friendly manner, "Nah, it's all right, man." And the three men left him. So what do you say? Oh, that comes up here. Okay. Let's see. Several years ago, six committed Christians, after much prayerful consideration, entered a General Electric plant in King of Prussia, Pennsylvania. They came armed with vials of their own blood and hammers. As they entered the plant, a security guard attempted to stop them and picked up the phone. Father Carl Cabot, one of the protesters, held the security guard from behind, restraining him but not harming him. The others made their way to the blueprints for a dangerous first strike weapon system, poured their blood over the blueprints, and then began hammering the missile system itself in an attempt to beat swords into plowshares. They then prayed together and awaited their arrest by the civil authorities. This is a situation that the whole peace community is just 50-50 divided on. You feel it's violent? Others? Okay. So, violent, was it good or bad?
The motive was good. I think they were trying to do something peaceful.
Mm-hmm. They did it in a rather unpeaceful way.
The restraint. Mm-hmm.
I guess pouring the blood wasn't so bad when they start wrecking property. Mm-hmm. Bothers me.
Okay.
And it bothers me how much trouble they're going to get in. And what does it prove?
So, would you put it violent and a little bad?
A little bad, yeah. Mm-hmm. Pouring their blueprints on the blood would ruin the blueprints too, wouldn't it?
Yeah, that was the intent. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Okay. E. In my near north side neighborhood, there's one boy, Clarence, who's extremely violent and has most of the little kids terrorized to go to the small park, which is in the center of our neighborhood. Clarence hides in the park, and when the little kids come, he shoots them with a rubber band gun. He pushes them off their bikes and plays other mean tricks on them and their families. Trips to confer with Clarence's parents rarely find anyone at home, often reveal an abusive situation, and rarely provoke any concern from the parents. One day, 14-year-old Clarence was pinching 5-year-old Mitchell when Hakeem, age 10, could no longer stand the abuse. He walked over to Clarence and stated that he was no longer going to put up with his bullying and socked him in the abdomen, freeing little Mitchell from Clarence's grasp and causing Clarence to flee the block. That was what Hakeem did to Clarence. Was it good or bad? Violent or nonviolent?
The outcome was good, even though the means were a little questionable.
So it was a violent act.
Yeah.
But it had a little bit of a good effect.
It had a good outcome.
Okay. I think we have time for maybe one or two more. Oh, we'll do two more because they're really good. Last Christmas, a middle-aged mother of 7 was walking home from the bus stop. Her arms were loaded down with boxes and shopping bags. Suddenly, she found herself overtaken by 2 young men. They came up from behind and separated at her shoulders. She was far from any residence where she was known. Before they could enclose her, before they could speak even a word, she beamed from one to the other, thrust out her packages, and told them how glad she was that they had come along. "I was rather nervous on this street, and these bags are so heavy, would you help me? Instinctively, they took the packages. The three then walked along together while the woman cheerily thanked them and told them how good they were to help.
Oh, we agree. We tried to find only true stories that fit all over, but every group puts some different ones.
And that's okay. Okay, here's another good one. It's going to be up there. We won't even bother with G where to put it, but it's a good story. A few years ago, a man got off the subway in New York City near Central Park when an assailant grabbed him by the arm, flashed a switchblade, and demanded, "Give me your wallet." This is Allen Ginsberg, by the way. The man warmly looked his assailant in the eyes and said, "I will give you my wallet, but you look so cold. Why don't you take my jacket, too?" The assailant looked at the man in disbelief. The man stated, "I was just going to the restaurant down the street. Why don't you join me for a cup of coffee or something to eat?" Trusting the man's integrity, the assailant joined him. They walked for an hour or so, or they talked for an hour or so about their lives, and at the end of the discussion, the man paid the bill and then turned to his assailant and said, "Here's my wallet, take it," holding his wallet out to him. The assailant refused the wallet, saying, "No, I could never take your wallet." They wished each other well and parted. That's obviously not that good. So hopefully you've gained some ideas in terms of what does a nonviolent and good response look like. Nonviolence usually seeks to reconcile. It doesn't use techniques that would demean the other person. It seeks to bring that person up and bring out the best in them. And again, there is a risk, but there's also a call to live out the Christian lifestyle and to deepen that lifestyle and what it means for us on the streets and in our everyday life. Mm-hmm.